council meeting for Tuesday, May 9th, 2017 to order. I'd like to welcome everyone here today. I have under 2.0 and no changes to the agenda. A motion to approve the agenda would be in order. So moved by Councilor Fisk, seconded by Councilor Fancy. Any discussion? Ready for the question?
Yes.
All those in favor? Thank you. We will now move on to presentations. Under 3.1, I have a presentation by Staff Sergeant Derek Smith, RCMP. I'd ask you to come forward, please. Councilor Fancy.
Were we supposed to ask if there's any changes to the agenda? Or
all part of that process, sir.
But, okay. Were we asked as councilors? So, or is it just that there were no changes?
There were no changes.
Nothing.
I didn't know if you called for changes.
Thank you, Your Worship.
Please get into your seats.
Say thank you for inviting me to your meeting. I have provided the March police report. I'll discuss just a couple of things that's been going on. One of them's very recent, as in last week, was that we had on one evening on May the 1st, we had two attempts to break into a convenience store in Liverpool. The evidence would suggest to us that people came and they tried to throw a rock through the front window of the convenience store. Didn't work. All three were wearing masks. They left and came back 10 minutes later and were successful this time on throwing a rock through the front window. We have, last week, our members were exceptionally busy dealing with that, and the fallout of several other reciprocal complaints. We, over the weekend, charged three individuals. Later today, there will be a press release going out. And the only reason for the delay in the press release was that today we hope to have the information or the charges actually laid, and so we'll be putting those persons' names out in the media. But last week, like I say, our members were exceptionally busy, did a great bang-up job on teamwork to bring that one to a successful conclusion, in my opinion. Those individuals will be going to court on July 12th, I think, off the top of my head. They've all been released on conditions including a 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. curfew. So hopefully that will put an end to our issues until that works its way with those particular individuals, until that works its way through the court process. I just want to talk a little bit about our file from the fatal house fire that we had down in Port Jolly. We have applied for provincial and federal awards for the young fellow that ran in and rescued that lady. I know that's been in the press. There's a bit of a process that if he receives the federal award before he receives the provincial award, he's no longer entitled to get the provincial award. So you know what steps we're trying to do first. So that is underway. Because I think that in all seriousness, and I know it was out in the local newspaper that the young fellow's a true hero. I can't put it any other way than that. I personally, on one occasion, tried to enter a burning residence a number of years ago, and I couldn't get in the residence other than the first foot or two. I wasn't in far enough to say that I got in. So I understand exactly some of what that, from a personal perspective, what that young fella did. Kim Maslin, as everybody knows, I think everybody knows, she's on the election trail. She's our senior safety coordinator. She's on a leave of absence until the end of the election. And of course, if she is successful, then that will be the end of Kim Maslin as our senior safety coordinator, which will be a significant gap for us to fill. But having said that, so right now, things that she has been doing have sort of fallen to Constable Rob James, our community policing coordinator. Kim was working on a very large seniors expo that's for the, off the top of my head, I think it's the 29th of May. So that, her role in that has all fallen to Constable James to pick up the torch there. Not that he wasn't involved in it last year, but he's picked up significant work that way. And so he and Kim always had worked close together anyway, so he's become, for lack of better terms, our de facto senior safety coordinator for whatever he can do. So to help fill that gap. The other thing that I wanted to discuss briefly is that I know when I met with council to talk about our annual performance plan, we had talked about some traffic, some crosswalk issues, and some signage issues. I have Joe Kroll, the provincial traffic authority, going to be in town on Friday to review those crosswalks and that signage. If somebody has another issue that has crops up into your mind between now and Friday, if you can give me a call, I will pay him handsomely with a large coffee instead of my customary medium one. Like I say, that he's going to be here at 8:30 on Friday morning. So like I say, as we all know, when we leave meetings, sometimes we sort of sit there and think, wish I'd have mentioned that. It's your final chance. I shouldn't say final chance, but so that's that. And then just to talk a bit about our personnel issues. Constable Shelley Levy, she has received a transfer notice. She is going to be going to our headquarters building to work in what's called Federal Serious Organized Crime. That's a reflection on, they don't just take anybody to work in that section. That is one that you have to earn the respect of our headquarters people. So she is very fortunate. We're going to have a gap to fill there. Her replacement for that is a fellow by the name of Constable Chad Burridge. He is coming from Lunenburg County, I expect him here on June the 11th. Now, Constable Levy, before she goes, will probably want to sell her house, so we could have an overlap, depending on, I'm not even sure her house is on the market yet, but it's, so we could have a bit of an overlap there. The other member that's outgoing this year is Constable Josh McKenzie. He's going to the Criminal Intelligence Service in Bridgewater. Again, not necessarily an easy position to get into, but he's going to that. He's leaving probably within the next couple of weeks, and his replacement is coming from Bonavista, Newfoundland, and should be here mid-July. So there'll be a bit of a gap there, but I'm expecting that Constable Burridge, who's going to fill in for Constable Levy, will. So I think we should be okay, other than maybe for the next week or two of being down a body. So that's our personnel issues. The armed robberies that we had, one of them I'm really, really optimistic that we're going to have a resolution to. And I don't want to say too much more than that on it. But we're making some real good inroads on one of them. The other one, I thought we were making some really good inroads and things didn't work out as I had thought. But other than that, I think everything else in the report speaks for itself. I don't know if anybody else has any questions, but see what I can answer.
Thank you. Any councillors have any questions of Sergeant Smith? Councillor Crowley?
I would be interested in the Traffic Authority meeting on Friday. Firstly, because I wasn't here for the original meeting, so I'm not sure what crosswalks you're talking about. But I know that we had an issue, Councillor Kelly and myself had an issue about a complaint but a crosswalk over by Tim Hortons, which is, was that on the list, you remember?
I don't think so. No, I don't think that came forward.
Okay.
So if you want, we can talk about that.
We'd like to talk about that one, and that's for a hearing impaired person, so it's a little bit more complicated. And the second part is Park Street. We've been receiving a lot of complaints, always have received a lot of complaints about this small street that has, correct me, 16 children located around Hempstead County in that area. And since we started the construction, it's been really bad, and I've got several complaints from people on that street. So I've encouraged everybody to phone the RCMP to complain, because I believe that's the only way that people are going to understand how severe it is. So I would appreciate talking to the traffic authority and yourself about Park Street and what can be done.
Okay, and what I can tell you is that yesterday, I know we did get a complaint about Park Street. I did task Constable James today. I said, you have one mission today, and only one mission, and that hopefully he doesn't think he can go home after that, but is to get the radar trailer here. So that is, which was in part related to that. So I hope he doesn't go to Lunenburg County, get it, and think that he can leave after he does that. But hopefully that'll be here today or tomorrow.
I also think that it's a long term. We need something there, some signage. I tried to get some signs before about kids playing, and we had the tennis court there as well. For some reason, that street seems to be one of the worst, along with Summer Street, and it's because they have a lot of children, and people feel they can just drive excessive speeds there. But I had no success with the signs on the route that I had gone, so maybe that's something. And I've talked to the region as well about putting temporary construction signs there, because again, it's the start of the construction, but not really, so people are being made aware of it, but not really slowing down until they actually see the construction. So it's a bit of a hodgepodge there right now. So hopefully they don't help other into it.
Okay.
Right on.
Councilor Kelly?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you about what is your process at the moment, and how are the RCMP at this local level involved in the cannabis issue, legalization of cannabis?
Right now at the local level, we're waiting for direction from our headquarters. That's essentially it. We aren't doing a whole lot with small seizures. Not that we've done a lot with small seizures anyway. Yesterday we seized a very small amount off of an individual. We are not laying any charges or anything like that at this point in time. We're just going to let that. But we've seized and we'll destroy it, because the person's not lawfully allowed to have it. But even the process for us when we make a small seizure, and yesterday it would probably be less than a gram, no more than a gram anyway, what we have to do is keep that for 60 days and then get permission from Health Canada to destroy it. And then once we do destroy it, we have to report back to Health Canada that we have destroyed it. So this file stays open and keeps in someone's queue for probably about 4 or 5 months. By the time that all works through the process. So it is pretty cumbersome, especially for, it wouldn't matter if we laid a charge or not, other than the fact that we do then bring other people into the equation. It's probably a 4 or 5 month process to deal with less than a gram of marijuana.
Right.
So, but anyways, so to answer your question, to be succinct and blunt, we're waiting for direction from our headquarters on that.
So right now there's no, I don't know, summary directive or anything like that to say like what kind of things that the RCMP would be concerned about to make sure that are part of the law? Like what kind of things concern you about the legalization of marijuana here in our municipality?
Yeah, some of the things that concern me obviously are the, and not that it hasn't been a concern, but I think it would be more prevalent will be the people that are driving impaired. That's certainly one of the things. Access should become more prevalent, obviously, and so I'm concerned about that ending up in younger people's hands. But those would be the two the two primary issues for me. Not that I mean, I think it's naive to believe that it's not in the hands of young people now, but I just feel that it's going to be more opportunity for it to be in the hands of younger people. And I'm not too sure what the public's position or public's perception of that will be, you know, but it concerns me a lot.
But can I just understand too that the RCMP would be involved, the provincial government, in shaping the laws for provincial laws for this?
Well, and that's all when the final legislation rolls out. My understanding is that a lot of this will be downloaded to provincially, from what I can gather. And so yes, the RCMP and what I would think through the Nova Scotia Chiefs of Police Association would be the conduit for how that's going to be addressed, so that there's one voice. That would be my guess as to how that would be. I don't know if they would take individual representations from all the police agencies in Nova Scotia or not, but I would tend to think it would come through the Nova Scotia Chiefs of Police Association.
Two major concerns I'm hearing at the moment are the legal age, and also smoking in public.
Yep. Yeah. Well, I mean, and obviously, I'll make a note of that. The age is too little, or the age is too young, or age
right
is too old.
I think that the federal government is suggesting 18.
Teen, yeah.
Councillor Kelly, I'm going to move on to Deputy Mayor if you have another question. Deputy Mayor McLeod.
Staff Sergeant Smith, good to have you here to present your report. Thank you. A couple things. First of all, when you reported that there was some issues with a convenience store and you had charged the young people, is that reported by the general public, or how do you know about these events when they happen?
Because
you want more public input in reporting crimes.
Right. This one came through as a glass break alarm, and so in other words, like the first instance, had that not happened, or had these persons just left, we might not never ever know about that, because maybe the store owner would never know about that. I mean, if the rock would have stayed in front of the window or in front of the door, when their staff would have come in the morning, they might have then gone back and reviewed their footage, their video footage. And that's how we know that they were wearing masks at the time, or we knew at the outset. As a result of our investigation, we also know that they were wearing masks.
That's basically how it was.
Yeah.
So that comes up to the fact that most businesses should be alerted. They should have some type of alarm system or video system to help with that.
We're big supporters of that. A big proponent of that. I'm also a proponent of calling the police to report things, and calling at the time makes a big difference. It's not uncommon. We had a call this morning about a vehicle driving unsafely yesterday in Caledonia, with no descriptors, so that not too much could be done anyway, unless we happen to have a car in the area. But it's really difficult for us to do something today about something that happened yesterday, except it does give us the knowledge that things are right and where we can address our energies.
My second concern is not a concern, but basically when there are large events at Queen's Place, we've had a lot lately, which is wonderful. I'm wondering about the congestion at the traffic lights and whether there can be, I don't know whether there be, could be communication between the manager of Queen's Place and letting you folks know that there's going to be a big event, and to keep the traffic flowing, because it does back up quite significantly at that exit 19. At the intersection when you come off of 8 and
highway. And the highway?
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the lights, yeah.
Okay. So you're not referring to right when you're leaving the complex or the facility itself, you're thinking more
at the lights, because the lights are programmed, and they're programmed to, you know, for slow nighttime traffic. I think they're programmed more differently at night than they are during the day.
Right.
So when that happens, that keeps that traffic. You know, I actually think it's a little bit faster at nighttime, but it gets congested way back to sometimes back to the the other exit or entrance to Queens Place, a lot of the traffic is backed up way back there. So just maybe keep an even flow if that's possible to do that.
Okay.
Just to be aware that there could be some major congestion.
Councillor Fisk? Yeah. No. Councillor Johnson?
I believe I had a sidebar with Staff Sergeant before the meeting, and he had mentioned that they're doing a study with regarding the senior safety coordinator, and in light of the fact of the charge that's put in front of staff, there may be some synergies there to pull those two pieces together and work together on some of the findings, so we're not each trying to reinvent the wheel or what each other's mandates are. So it's something for staff to consider, whoever the CAO appoints to that task.
And I'll just speak to that briefly, and I apologize for losing my train of thought on that, but we had been asked to supply information to our district office in New Mines, but I'm assuming that they're collecting for Southwest Nova, and there's similar surveys underway in Northeast Nova as well as out of Metro for the duties and the details and the funding for the senior safety coordinators. And Kim and Rob had completed that documentation and sent it forward. So if I was a betting man, and I certainly don't bet, but there is going to be some sort of at least an undertaking or an understanding of who's paying for what and how those positions are funded and what services are being, generally speaking, provided. So I would tend to think at some point in time we're going to try to make sure that we're consistently providing the same level of service across Nova Scotia, or I shouldn't say we, but the senior coordinators are. I mean, I know that we we're one of the conduits for them for sure. Like I say, we provide office space and whatnot for the one in the region of Queens. The next county over towards Halifax, I know that's the office space is funded out of the town of Bridgewater. The town of Bridgewater supplies an out-of-service police car, in other words, an end-of-life vehicle becomes that one, where I know in the region of Queens that comes under the VON generously, provides access to a vehicle. And in part, there's no way to get an end-of-life RCMP vehicle easily. So those are all the sort of like the different, I think, things that will come up out of that survey. But it would be nice to get everybody on the same field and funded the same way, just for fairness to everybody in the whole process.
Yes, I have Councillor Fancy here.
Going back to the lights have multiple problems. The one is again the questions Councillor Kelly has brought up about the noise to be able to for people who are impaired. But coming out of Sobeys, that is of course if there's no one coming out of Sobeys, it just skips out. It goes along and it goes the cycle goes through and forgets about that. Along with that, there's two things that go along with that. If you come up and you press a button to walk across and there's no car there, it doesn't know. It'll go on and you can't walk across because the light. So when you press that button to go walk across, the light should come on. That should do the same thing as a car coming up with the weight of the car. I go up to a bicycle board and it doesn't recognize the bicycle because I don't have enough weight. So
you can fix that.
So if that button could do the same thing as pressing the crosswalk, we do the whole gamut, it would work. The other thing too, which I find can work quite effectively, is when you're coming out of Sobeys, because we always had that same problem with people coming into Tim Hortons. I was here the other day and I heard somebody just laying on the horn because somebody had gone around, somebody else coming in, somebody else couldn't even turn in because they're backing up going towards Bristol. Would it be possible, or is it even right to move where the car goes up to the light, move back about 10 feet? If you move, I tried that the other day, just stayed back a bit, So then people could come in and they could actually go around those cars and then come down to the Sobeys. If that line was drawn back, you know, away from the light about, you know, about 10 feet, then that would give you access to get in there, to go around those cars and go around there. I don't know if that's, you know, that it doesn't bring you right up to the light, but if it was set back, it would give you a space. But I tried that and it worked really good. People come in there like that, but then I wasn't up far enough to set off the light to, so it skipped me in my turn. I had to wait.
Can I ask you to come see me before Friday?
Yeah.
So I can sort of like sketch some of this stuff out when I'm in front of Mr. Kroll?
Because I laid back, just you know, about 10 feet back, and the cars were in there, and they just went around the other cars and right in. If you had a line drawn there, and that's as far as you're supposed to go up, that would help get people to go around there. But then again, I wasn't up far enough to set off the light to go in.
Yeah. Well, if I could ask you maybe just so I can draw some sketches
sure,
or whatever,
okay.
And so I can get his advice. As you know, I'm the traffic authority for the region, or
yeah.
for the town of what would have been the town of Liverpool.
Yeah.
And I take all my guidance from Mr. Kroll. Because to be honest with you, I'm not trained in that, and actually, that is one of the things that the RCMP is getting out of the business of being the traffic authorities and where we do have it. I know that they've given it up in the next county over, and for that reason is that we change positions and whatnot, and we get a bunch of untrained people.
Yes.
Doing those jobs, and but I'm still maintaining that for now,
okay.
And I will maintain it as long as I can, provided I can keep Mr. Kroll on site. So.
Just a couple things that have sparked an interest in my questions from these comments. First of all, getting back to the senior safety program, I happen to be a member on the senior safety program committee. And it's always sort of been there hasn't been any organization that has really been the umbrella for the senior safety. And I think the VON may be considering making some changes with that program so that there is a qualified organization that would really chair the meetings. And they've been doing it haphazardly or just on a volunteer
yep.
basis. So that might bring into some sort of more organized fashion for that. And also, they would be the ones that would do the funding applications, because I think the funding applications actually came through Kim herself, I believe, who filled up the applications here. So there's some works in that department. Secondly, the traffic, I was going to say, now, street closures. When you talk about you no longer being a traffic authority for the region or for the town of Liverpool, and if there are street closures and that sort of thing that are required for events and that sort of thing, was the traffic authority always contacted in that regard and had to give permission, or is that the municipality that had to authorize the street closures? Does anybody know that? Traffic authority.
Yeah, I get the request.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then that goes to Joe Kroll or his department.
Well, if they're for the what would have been the town of Liverpool, I get them myself, and typically what I'll do is I'll look at them, see if they were historically done, and if they've been historically done without sort of any issue behind them, then I tend to just agree to allow them to continue. Anything that's new, I'll sort of like to have an extra bit of a look at, for lack of better terms. But I, like for example, like Privateer's Days, I know that I just approved everything that was sort of, you know, historically done for the last 75
yes.
years or
yes.
whatever. I'm not about to change history, nor do I think there's a reason for me to change history. I mean, obviously, had I thought there would be, then I might have. But last year was my first Privateer's Days, but like I said, I thought things went fine. But if it's outside the town of Liverpool, then those approvals do come from Mr. Kroll. And he will send me eventually, or the organizers are, I do get copies of the permits, just as an advisory to us as the police, you know, and that would include for parades, walkathons, and things like that.
So if your position, if you want to give it up as the RCMP being the traffic authority, then it goes to the Joe Pro.
I'm not sure what would happen.
So we just
want
to make sure that we don't get delayed with these decisions because
right.
it's important.
Yeah, no.
You're right here, but.
Yeah, no, I can check with the next county down to see what they did.
Sure.
Some
things are kind of not the last minute decisions, but you know, you don't want to hold up an event or something.
Yeah, oh, absolutely right.
Yeah.
Councillor Kelly?
Just one last thing too. I want to ask you about in previous years we've had a medication amnesty,
yep.
if you want to call it. Are you having one again this month?
No.
Like this year? No. Okay.
No. For a couple of reasons. One is just 1 second now. They're not really all that well attended.
Okay.
We do quite and not that the I'm not sure if everybody understands this. At any time, you can take unused medications to the pharmacy and have them destroyed. I'm not sure that everybody understands that necessarily, but I can tell you that both here and the other county over, where we would do a lot of work, and part of it was we had a police presence at it, thinking that if everybody brings in all of a sudden a bunch of narcotics, then things are ripe for things to go wrong. But really, there has been no very limited attendance at those. And that's just not, that's not a local thing. That's a provincial thing. The last year was last year for that.
Mayor McLeod?
I know. You seem to be really into good conversations here this morning. This is good stuff. Regarding the prescriptions, and the other day I just happened to have my prescription bottle and it had zero on it, so. You know, I didn't need to send that to the pharmacy anymore. And I thought, well, do I put it in the garbage, put it in the recycle? So I think there should be some concern for these bottles that are put in the waste, because if somebody gets a hold of that, then they'll know what kind of prescription somebody is taking. And, you know, that person's name is on there, so they might be able to identify. So that might be something that you might want to consider looking into.
That comes down to personal information that people throw out. I know that any of those that I have myself, I take them off. Now I happen to be fortunate; I have a wood stove. But any of those labels, any of the little magazine things, I personally throw those. Like I'll cut those off. I'll put the rest of the magazine in the when I'm done with them to go with my regular recycling. But I tend
it's
to take
to
anything.
Take those labels off.
Yeah, well, yeah, you want to believe it.
Yeah.
But as long as you can get enough off that it gets rid of your name.
Yeah.
I mean, not that
or
we've had.
Or return them to the pharmacy.
Pardon me?
The empty bottles,
yeah. And knock on wood, but it's not that uncommon in some jurisdictions where people know someone is just passed away from something such as cancer, for people to break into houses on the day of the funeral. Right, because people expect that there will still be, a serious amount of significant medications in those residences, and which I know I'm going off on a little bit of a tangent here, but lots of times we will take the medications with us when we attend sudden deaths, turn those in to be destroyed, which helps eliminate some of that. But that's not an uncommon phenomenon, unfortunately, is to prey on. You know, somebody of the, you know, obviously the worst times in their lives, and so.
Just one in response to the young gentleman that did an act of bravery in Port Jolly, I would suggest that maybe the council could make a resolution commending the young person at one of our next council meetings, so that we would have a public commendation for that.
Thank you. Any other questions of councillors? Thank you, Staff Sergeant. Very appreciated today.
Thank you. Sorry for being long-winded.
Okay, we'll move on to 3.2, a presentation today by Amanda Labors on the Mercy Tobiac Research Institute.
Thank you. you for having me. Honorable Mayor and councillors, good morning.
Good morning.
Hello to everyone.
You're lucky you knew the password.
Yeah, I'm kind of blanked on that. Better be, I'm not very quick-witted this morning, obviously. Thank you for having me again. I've been trying to make a habit of having some regular visits this way, so this is my spring visit to council to tell you about what's happening at the Merseytopiac Research Institute. I'm sure this is something that you talk about often, but you know that 45 minute to 1 hour distance can be quite a barrier, not only for us to know what's going on here, but also for you to know what's happening for us in North Queens. So that's part of the reason for my regular trek in the springtime. But because I haven't spoken to all of you about it, I'm going to just go over some very basic things, which will be for sure a repetition for some of you. And then hopefully leave enough time that we can have some discussion. So, this. The mission of our organization, which is a nonprofit charitable cooperative, is that we promote the sustainable use of natural resources and biodiversity conservation in the Southwest Nova Biosphere Reserve and beyond through the through research, education, and the operation of a field station. So I just want to put this up. This is a mission which we revisit on a five-year basis, and it's something that all members of our cooperative have a say in. Our vision, what we would imagine if in an ideal world where we were doing our job, is that we would have prosperous and knowledgeable human communities where decisions that have any kind of biodiversity implications are well informed by research, where species are not at risk, where there is landscape and aquatic connectivity, healthy forests, and healthy aquatic ecosystems. We do have over 800 members and 50 partner organizations, companies, or departments. Oops, I skipped one. So just to give you a little snippet of the history of our organization, we were incorporated in 2004, and the Region of Queens Municipality was one of our founding members, along with you know, some companies which aren't any longer with us, Douglas's, Bowwaters, but also most of the community college and universities and other organizations. This has grown. Part of the reason I want to just show you a visual of some of our partners is to make it clear that we do work across quite a spectrum from our point of view in terms of our mission. We're working with companies like Port Hawks Free Paper very closely, but we also work with very environmentally minded organizations like the Nature Conservancy of Canada. We have one of our main strengths is that we really are built on people power. We have a very dynamic base of volunteers. They are totally engaged in the work that we do. Being the sort of nerdy, scientific, mathematically minded people that we are, we love to count things up. We count up all the hours that our volunteers pitch in, and in partnership with Parks Canada and Bird Studies Canada, the kind of work that our volunteers are doing in southwestern Nova Scotia adds up and has added up to over 10,000 hours per year. We're now at 160,000 hours since 2007. So people are getting their hands dirty, following around piping plovers, covering turtle nests, and are, you know, really, it's not just that they are members, it's that they're really involved. We have lots of energy and enthusiasm, but I also want to convey during my presentation the kind of business that we're operating and give you a sense of our business history. So if you look at the graphs, you can see our story is one of growth. In terms of our gross income and our total assets, we've invested in our community in North Queens. We attract about $600,000 a year in revenue, and we have a staff that is totals about 12 people all year round. We add to that, this year we're adding to that about 10 summer students, so we have a labor force of over 20 people a year, which is significant for North Queens. We attract scientists and enrich the lives of residents who are involved in the work that we do, and we've been quite busy over the last number of years fostering other businesses and cooperatives, which I'll tell you about in a minute. there are three pillars of MTRI. Whenever I give these talks, I always point out that there our structure, our governance structure, and our activities, the work that we do, it's all very consistent with our mission. And same thing with our pillars. I'm going to talk to you about research, education, and the operation of a field station. The word research is right in our name, so most people immediately think of that. But certainly our education and outreach work and our field station are also very important to us. So just touch on these things. We can get into them in more detail later. I'd love to have, if you haven't already, have you come visit our field station. We're a place-based organization. We wouldn't exist anywhere else. It's very important to us that we are where we are. We received just a couple of months ago the People's Choice Award from the Town of Bridgewater's Living Energy Laboratory for some of the innovative things that we're doing with our field station. So we employ green technologies, but we also have a common space to attract the public and accommodations for researchers. There's a graph there at the top that just shows you what happened as our business was growing. We began to consume more and more power, and because we wanted to walk the talk, we decided we would do everything in our power to try and turn our power bill around. So we renovated in 2010, we implemented a lot of energy conservation measures, and we added 30% to our square footage of our building, but we reduced our power bill by 55%. We continue to work on that, trying to monitor and improve our energy conservation, but we have videos about this, and we'd certainly give in-person tours to show you our solar, geothermal, and wind green technologies. So that's the first pillar of our work. The second is about education and outreach. So there are a number of things that we do right on site. As far as education and outreach go, we also work with the media and host workshops, seminars, both on-site and off-site. We have a number of publications, both in the scientific literature, but also publications that are more accessible to the public. So we print these guides, for example, which have become very popular. We tend to print about 10,000 at a time. We have a sort of catalog of our research, a website that's quite active and presence on social media. So while we're doing our research, it's always been primary to us that we make sure that we're sharing that. It's important that we're sharing that with scientists and we're getting the credit in articles that are being peer-reviewed, but also we want to make what we learn easy for the public to understand, whether that's by having articles in magazines or newspapers or opening up our doors for regular seminar series in the summer or free monthly talks in the winter. That's always a big part of what we're doing. But I'll talk now about the sort of the main pillar, and that is our research and monitoring. All of this is underpinned by a strategic plan, which we have, which sort of breaks everything down, how we're going to get closer to our mission. There are three themes where we're most active, and a lot of our work is project-based. I won't talk about the work that we do with invasive species or climate change because we're just not as active in that. Excuse me. But I will give you a few examples about some of our aquatic health work, species at risk, and healthy forests. And what I've done is I've just given you a collage that sort of indicates the kind of projects that we have. We run a couple dozen projects a year, so it's not possible for me to really provide you with very much detail about those, but I've chosen a couple of examples of things that are sort of new that happened over the past year under each of these themes. So as far as aquatic health goes, we've done a lot of work looking at fish passability with our different partners. We measure for fish passability, we've been working with the Clean Annapolis River Project as well as Parks Canada. We measure water quality. We worked really closely with the Tuscut River Environmental Protection Association in the Yarmouth area and Carleton area. This is a picture of a loon. Its head is just covered with a blanket there, but we work really closely with the Canadian Wildlife Service and a group out of Maine called the Biodiversity Research Institute to test the blood of loons in our area. Here's a picture with Deb Ryan from County of Annapolis. and some of our staff on the shore of Sandy Bottom Lake trying to install signage that lets people know more about smallmouth bass and chain pickerel, so invasive fish that are threatening our waterways. We've worked with the Blue Nose Coastal Action Foundation to produce this map, as well as the Salmon Federation and other fishing groups who are interested in knowing where we might apply terrestrial liming. The Medway Salmon Association's another group. So that's just a sort of smorgasbord of the kinds of projects that we are working on for aquatic health. And last year, there were a couple of new things I thought might be worth mentioning today. We had our first highlight on Land and Sea, CBC's television program. Here's a picture. There's me and one of my coworkers, Colin Gray, with one of our volunteers, Jim Moore, is up at Tupper Lake. He lent us his workshop for the entire summer last year to build loon platforms. We also got a lot of help from the Nova Scotia Community College Bridgewater campus. So we've built 20 loon platforms, all based on a design from a couple of guys that we call the Gregs on Fancy Lake near Bridgewater. They've been really successful in having the loons on their lake actually nest on this platform, which can respond to fluctuating water levels, very relevant on days like today, to try to improve the reproductive success of loons. This is something that we've been doing research on for decades with Environment Canada, and last year we kind of changed the focus of our project from research to starting to do something about it. So we've been working closely with people who live near lakes because they have to bring these platforms in and out before the lakes freeze, and then again right after they thaw, because the loons usually arrive within days of the lakes thawing. So there's a bit of a commitment that's required, but it's a great episode, and it's available on YouTube if you want to have a look and learn more about what we've been doing with loons. So we're quite pleased to spend about a week with the Land and Sea film crew to highlight the work that we're doing. And the mayor has been very helpful in his role through Queens County Fish and Game in helping us to set up a new creel census in the Medway District. So last year, with funding through the Nova Scotia Department of Fisheries and Aquaculture, we began what's called a creel census, which I didn't actually know what that meant at the beginning, but it actually means that you're interviewing anglers. So we have summer students who will stand in the black flies on the side of some dirt roads up the Medway and ask anglers if they're willing to have us look at their fish. And if they are, then we collect genetic samples, fish scales to age the fish. And if they don't have any fish in hand, we still ask them a series of questions to try to understand how hard are they trying to catch fish and how successful are they being. This is the kind of work that the Department of Fisheries and Aquaculture and other nonprofits have done throughout Nova Scotia and I'm sure throughout North America. So then we can compare what's the fishing like in the Upper Medway, and we can provide a baseline because the roads have really, the access to those roads has changed. We want to get some baseline information, and we're also really interested in knowing whether there are any invasive fish up in this area, which was previously owned by Bowater and gated so that there wasn't public access. So those are a couple new projects that we've been working on and will continue to work on this summer as far as our aquatic health theme goes. If you've heard about our organization at all, you probably have heard about it in the context of species at risk. This is a biodiversity hotspot in Canada. There are about three places in Canada which have a disproportionate amount of, or you could say just like a whole shebang of rare and interesting species. And the reason that that's true here is mostly an accident of our glacial history and the shape of our province, but that's a story for another day. I'll just give you a little sense of the kind of endangered species that we work on with these images. We've worked with the Department of Natural Resources now for many years and launched a bat hotline to try to monitor what's happening post-white nose syndrome with our different species of bats that live here. In the middle, there's a picture of what some might consider a lowly lichen, but in fact, one of our most endangered species in Nova Scotia. is a cyanolichen called the boreal felt lichen. It's disappeared almost entirely from the rest of the world. Nova Scotia and Newfoundland are the last places where it's hanging on. And interestingly, this provides a great opportunity for us to work with forest companies because we can predict where it lives, we can search it out and find it, and then we can work really proactively with forest companies to leave buffers around the trees. Most endangered species run around at high speeds. It's really hard to find where they are. Lichens, we say, are slow moving. They do move over the course of decades, but we can predict where they are and do something to keep their habitat. There's only a handful now of chimneys left in Nova Scotia where chimney swifts roost. This is a picture of one from McGowan Lake. We work with Nova Scotia Power, and in fact, we're meeting with them tomorrow to monitor and manage that chimney. We have a butterfly club that has over 1,000 people who have paid money to buy from us swamp milkweed, which is the only plant that monarch butterflies will lay their eggs on. So we're proactively trying to work with gardeners to create better habitat for butterflies, including the endangered monarch butterfly. We have a team of botanists who have been atlasing lakes. Queens County is an amazing place for Atlantic coastal plain flora. This little yellow flower lives on Briar Island and nowhere else in the world except for the tops of some mountains in New Hampshire. And we work with the Nature Conservancy of Canada, and we've actually been doing something very interesting there on Briar Island with bulldozers and heavy machinery to try and maintain the hydrology required for that plant. Here's a picture of a ribbon snake in the hand. And the critter that we get a lot of people excited about that has the, some people say the sun under its chin, the Blanding's turtle. So I'm just gonna mention in more detail two of these species that we work on and some new discoveries last year. Last year was an amazing year for us, for some of our young researchers who had enough time on their hands really to connect with nature, to be out in the outdoors, and to make some amazing finds, which are scientifically very important. Two of our researchers who were on the Creel census, which means a bit of a night shift for us, forgot their fork one night when they were up on the Creel census, and because they were hoping to have supper, they decided to look in an old building, and they found a colony of bats there. And that wasn't the only one they found. Within a few weeks, they found another building slated for demolition with a colony of over 100 bats. So we're very excited because nowadays, I mean, that would not have been news a few years ago, as most of you know, but we've been working really closely with the Department of Natural Resources to make sure that those that habitat is maintained. Both buildings had been slated for demolition, so just in the nick of time. And we got a bit of media coverage about that, but we're keeping it hush-hush and secret. And I just realized I probably told a little too much information. Might have put the two projects together and figured out where they are. I'll have to trust you not to disturb them. another project with a lot of excitement last year was our Blanding's turtle project. There were some areas that had been slated for forest harvest, and some local anglers noticed all the flagging tape. They alerted us that they knew that there were Blanding's turtles in this area. So we, with the support of the Department of Natural Resources, because this was a Crown land harvest, arranged it so that our researchers could have enough time to look for ribbon snakes and Blanding's turtles in this area in advance of the harvesting. And Freeman's Lumber Company has been very supportive. They've provided access behind the mill through closed gates that we can do our surveys. We've named a few turtles after some of the staff at Freeman's. We're now at over 45 new Blanding's turtles in this population, which makes it just as important as the one in Kedgy, McGowan, or Pleasant River from our perspective. So our research in that area is ongoing. It's in the, well, obviously you'll know where I mean, because I mentioned Freeman's, that it's in the Greenfield area. Excuse me. So there's a little glimpse of a couple of our species at risk projects last year. And now I'm on to the last of our research themes, which is about forest health and landscape connectivity. Again, quite a number of projects that are being undertaken at any time at our research station. We have done research in the past on wildlife such as flying squirrels. We work with Parks Canada to look at hardwood regeneration using prescribed burning as well as other methods. Aerial surveys, there's a picture there. We work really proactively with private landowners to understand how best to manage their lands. Can't quite get rid of that clock, but let's see. Oh, I'm stuck. There we go. So I want to mention a few projects that were new for us last year. One is that we focused on women in forestry. And there's been a bit of a critical mass that's developed with some of our own staff and other professional foresters here in the Queens and Lunenburg areas. And those of us who have become accustomed to sitting in rooms full of men talking about forestry have been really excited that there actually were two or three of us in rooms full of men talking about forestry. And we found, we think, and I can speak for myself, I think that some of our forestry issues aren't separate from gender issues. So it's been exciting for us to start to explore that. And we called a circle of women working in a professional capacity in forestry about a year ago. We had quite a response. Probably a dozen women in the province who work in forestry joined our conference calls, and we decided to host a series of workshops just for women. So we hosted three workshops. Here's some pictures from the last one. We tried to have all women facilitators, but for the last one where we wanted to especially inspire young women, we had quite a few participants from the Community College campus in Bridgewater in their natural resources program. We wanted to inspire them to learn more about the real nitty-gritty of forestry. So we had Eisner's Forestry host us at a site in Rosignol, an active forestry site. So you can see they're doing some partial cutting there. You can see some images. They allowed us to get right up into the machines. So they shut down for an hour so that we could try out the machines. And then we also had Al Agronon from the Forestry Safety Council bring a simulator to MTRI and give all the women in the course a chance to actually try their hand at working machines. So there's a little glimpse of one of three series. We decided we just had too many ideas to just do one. So each one had a different focus. One was focused on non-timber forest products, another was focused on outdoor skills, navigation, and this one was more focused on the business and commercial side of machine-based forestry. We've also been working on old forests. So again, I'm using these examples in a way to show you kind of a juxtaposition. It's true that we work on old forests and endangered species, but we also work quite a lot on forestry issues and the business of forestry. So totally swinging to the other side, we had a local filmmaker, Katie Hopkins, help us with former Olympic athlete Jenna Martin on location at Kedmakush National Park. There's an image here of her, a sweet little video. It's available on the internet if you want to look at sort of her thoughts as she's running through an old forest. We had a billboard in Halifax. Here's an image of it. We also had oversubscribed seminars in the woods where we were teaching people the skills so that they could measure and assess old forests. We had to put on extra of these, and I should have said with the women in forestry, we also had a waiting list, so lots of great response. Here's an image at the bottom left, your bottom left, yeah, of the conference that we held. We do hold about one science conference a year. We went up to DeBert this year because we wanted to get people involved from PEI New Brunswick as well. So our Old Forest Conference had over 100 participants. For the first time, we did a multi-day conference with field trips. That was a great success. I have spoken to you in the past about our certification project, so I thought it was probably worth me giving you a bit of an update that Over the past year, our certification pool, which we share with the Federation of Woodlot Owners, has grown to 40 local woodlot owners, and throughout the province there are 130 altogether. So these landowners all chip in a fee to help split the costs of a third-party audit, which happens every year, and this year was our five-year recertification audit. So there are over 12,000 hectares of FSC-certified land in this pool, and we've recently begun a process of merging our certificates with a group in Cape Breton, so we'll have greater efficiencies, and MTRI is taking the lead, especially on what's called the high conservation value, a forest component of this certification. Over the years, we've had more than 40 workshops, a number of training courses, over 600 participants who've been on the ground at demonstrations of the kinds of things you see in the pictures there. So our certified woodlot owners are proving to the auditors that they've installed their culverts correctly. Here's a picture of a minor non-conformance which had to be corrected by one of our woodlot owners in our last audit. You can see the drainage for this road wasn't correctly installed, so there he is reinstalling, reworking the road so that we can all pass the audit as a collective. I also mentioned, I think the last time that I was here, a prototype that I was involved with Patricia Amaro of Picea Forestry Consulting. This was a province-wide exercise funded by ACOA and the Nova Scotia Department of Natural Resources to try to find innovative solutions to some of the problems we have in forestry. Our prototype was to expand contractor capacity for partial harvest in Western Nova Scotia. So we were given 18 months and a $10,000 budget to try to figure out what we could about this problem. So we split up our team. Half of the discovery interviews occurred with contractors. Half of our work was interviewing landowners. And here's some of our conclusions. We found, despite the fact that everybody talks about this, that you can't find a contractor who'll do partial harvesting, we actually found 6 contractors who do partial harvesting in this area. So we do have the capacity, and those contractors do have versatile equipment, purpose-built machines, and the skilled and experienced operators that are required for the job. Through our discovery interviews with them, we realized part of our job was really nailing down some of the economics of this partial harvesting with private landowners. So we know that in order to sustain their businesses, they need 20 to 30,000 tons per crew per year, that the minimum job size they're looking for is 1,000 tons, and that clustering of woodlots is probably the way for us to be successful. So we put together a book of business and packaged or clustered woodlots in that FSC pool that I mentioned. What we found is that really the woodlot owners and the contractors have, there's some things about what they're looking for that's different, but there's enough middle ground that we think there's good potential for us to help to match them up. And so we will be hosting next week our first invite-only sort of meet and greet. We've been kind of a matchmaking type of agency, meet and greet. So we'll have a small group of landowners who are ready for partial harvesting see the contractors in action, much like we did with the women in forestry. But in this case, it's woodlot owners who are ready. They're ready with their management plans for harvesting. I guess I skipped ahead to that already. So this is, I think, my last slide where I'm just sort of pitching to you. I've gone over lots of information and only skimmed the surface, but here's some things that are coming up in 2017. Again, we'll have dozens of projects on the go, but I've just chosen 5 bullets there to tell you about what I think probably is at top of mind for council and everyone here in the room, and those are projects that have economic slants that are coming up. I'd be happy to take questions about them. So we've been helping to facilitate the North Queens Innovation and Business Hub. So you may know that that's in the back end of the fire hall in Caledonia, the new fire hall, that we have this new business hub. The business hub needed a charitable partner, and we were successful through the Rural Communities Foundation in getting a grant. So MTRI has received the grant on behalf of our partnership with the Business Hub, and it's about rural vitality. Something you guys are talking about all the time. We'll be trying our hand at making a mark on rural vitality in Caledonia through some series of training opportunities. We had our AGM, the Hub's AGM was just a week or two ago, and it was really, Councillor Johnson was there, really exciting. I think everybody is really well poised to take advantage of what we have at the Hub over the upcoming year. We want to build tourism partnerships, incubate innovation. MTRI has been the experimental site for the Hub's TV white space experiment, so we'll continue to run that experiment over the summer, see what effect the leaf out has on our the speeds of our internet there. So another project that's coming up, we've been working on for some time, I guess. This is a bit of a continuation, but I didn't have much chance to mention it during the presentation, so just want to flag for you, the Western Woodlot Service Cooperative has hired a new manager, Richard Scott. He's based out of the Bridgewater area, but that service cooperative will be offering services to private landowners who are interested through the summer, and we continue to lend support to the Medway Community Forest, whose Firewood Woodlot just happens to be across the street from us, and their new summer student assistant will be living on location at our field station. We partnered on a couple of Canada 150 projects, as many groups have. Our Shelburne Heritage River project includes a reconnaissance trip down the river, and we've got 8 paddlers who left an hour and a half ago. They're going to be a little wet over the next few days, but they'll be traveling the Shelburne Heritage River, singing O Canada. We've got a film crew coming to back for their arrival, and we've got a public barbecue when they arrive on the shores of Mary McKedge, on the shores of Kedgy Lake at Mary McKedge on Saturday. So trying to get the word out about our amazing rivers and wild places through that project. And we're also partnering with Parks Canada, who'll be hosting a 2-day bio blitz. We're gonna have our science meeting the day before. So in July, with the support, we've got a letter of support from Jill and the staff here at the Region of Queens. We appreciate that. And we were successful in our application to get funding to have public workshops about how people can get more engaged and learn to use tools like iNaturalist. So that'll be all in advance of Kedgy's BioBlitz, which will on the Saturday be in the main part of the park, and on Sunday it will be down here at the seaside. Number 4 point that I thought I would mention, and Gil asked me to speak about this a little more, so I'll try to do that with what time I have, which I'm sure is getting short. We have launched a feasibility study. So we've partnered with the town of Bridgewater, and we've also made a pitch to the municipality of the district of Lunenburg, and they have all been supportive. I think they were voting on the budget yesterday, so I can't say just what the dollar amount is, but Town of Bridgewater and MODL are interested in having MTRI look at how we could supply a sustainable source of biomass for district heating. And this is part of their sustainability planning and their quite innovative approach to energy long-term planning. So we're quite pleased to be working with them. We've already begun to interview experts. We will be modeling wood supply for what we're calling a sustainable woodshed, kind of like a watershed. So trying to actually show how far could you be trucking biomass material and have a good carbon output from that, or how to be greenhouse gas neutral. And how could you have a list of prerequisites so you know that biomass isn't the kind of dirty word that it's been in the newspapers, but actually that these materials are coming from sustainably managed long-term private woodlots or from the community forest. So that's what we're working on with them. Would really love to talk to your staff or council more about this. I think it's an amazing way that municipalities could start to get involved in something that could really have far-reaching effects as far as trying to secure local energy supplies and be more greenhouse gas neutral. Also along that vein, we've been on the ground in private woodlots this winter, and we will continue to work with our partners in New Brunswick and PEI to value carbon. So as part of the all these things that are happening on the national and provincial scene, there will be a price tag for carbon. And we know that the carbon that's in the soils of woodlots amounts to more than what's in the atmosphere or in the standing trees. The soil is where it's at. There are 10 times more carbon stores there. And some really exciting research that's been coming out of the United States is showing that partial harvesting is absolutely fundamental to keeping carbon in the soil. So we're excited to be working with our woodlot owners, who are excited to imagine that they might actually get some kind of remuneration for the kinds of goods and services that they're providing society. So that's a glance into the future for us.
Thank you, Amanda. Any councilors have questions for Amanda? Deputy Mayor McLeod?
Just a question, Amanda. This is really great information, and my gosh, you do a lot of work there. You've been with them for a long, long time, from their inception, I think, weren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yep, 2004.
Wow. Do you do any work with ticks? I know that the population are really concerned about that. Do you have any research on that?
We have lots of collections of ticks.
Yeah,
and
but
our field station is a great place to pick up some ticks, because
yeah,
we have so many people coming and going. There are scientists at Dalhousie and at Mount Allison. And we encourage our researchers, because they happen to pick up a lot of ticks, to collect them. And so we share collections with Mount Allison and Dalhousie. One of my colleagues, Brad Toms, happens to have a sort of personal interest in this. So he could certainly provide you with a lot more information than I could. But yeah, I think at Mount Allison, the focus there is particularly on the genetics. But there's a researcher now at Dalhousie who's also interested in, I think, more the disease side of things.
Yeah. Because it is a population concern, you know, we get every year forever. They'll never go away, but depending on how much information you have and how you can detect, because there's a scare out there for the Lyme disease, as you know.
Absolutely, yep. And we have safety procedures for our staff about how to try to avoid those things. But yeah, it's a hot topic, and it would be great if what's happening on the human side could actually kind of catch up what's happening on the veterinary side, because, yeah. We're a little behind,
though.
Councillor Frelick?
Great presentation, Amanda, as always. We always learn something new. One question about last year when we had the fires. What is your role, MTRI, after the fires? Is there anything that you have to do? Is there any sort of logging or anything that you just to kind of plan into action?
Yeah, great question. A large proportion of the fire occurred on the Crown land where the Medway Community Forest Co-op has a license. So the Medway Community Forest Co-op is separate from MTRI. We have two different boards of directors, but we have a person who sits on their board, and we work really closely with them on lots of things. So I know that they did do some salvage harvests. And in fact, went on a tour with Michael to see sort of what had happened afterwards. And from our organization's point of view, we've been sort of cooking up a funding proposal to look at what are the best ways of sort of post-fire, looking at how to remediate the soil there, because it was really burned right down to the rocks.
Yeah.
And what would be the right sort of balance of harvest versus remediation. So we're hoping. We had an attempt at a funding deadline, which was just too tight for us last year. So we're going to try again to this. It's called the SFI Canada, Sustainable Forestry Initiative, I think it is. So we'll be looking. We are interested in developing a research project in partnership with the MCFC. I think that, I can't remember, Richard, if it was you, who Mary Jane Rogers is the general manager for MCFC. And she wondered if she could jump in on my presentation, since I already had the slot this morning, and we realized it was too tight, and she's scheduled for
June 13th, I think.
So if you can wait until then.
Who is she again?
She's the general manager, so she's a professional forester, and
okay.
She's a general manager for the Medway Community Forest Co-op.
Okay.
And she was very busy with the fire last year. From our point of view, we actually housed firefighters, and it certainly impacted our lives and changed our access to the forest during that period. Hopefully it's not something we'll repeat again this summer.
Thank you.
Councillor Fisk?
Just follow up on Councilor McLeod, Deputy Councilor. The wood tick situation with the Lyme disease, how long has that been existing, the Lyme disease itself, that we know of?
That's an excellent question. I don't know the answer to.
Well, because let's say 30 years ago, we were not discussing Lyme disease, and all of a sudden now we are.
Mm-hmm.
And another quick question, a great presentation, no doubt. The bat situation, is that the population increasing?
The numbers are so low that if you ask a biologist like me, are the populations increasing, like, I would need to have a lot of confidence about knowing the population level, so I would probably give you a too technical answer for what you're looking for. The population levels are so low that we're not even sure whether we could count them. We were very encouraged to find these two maternity colonies, and we've launched another project. I keep saying this, but we're waiting for our word back from the Habitat Stewardship Program at Environment Canada. We're hoping to use acoustic monitors, which are deployed remotely. So the idea is that and the technology has really improved in this. We're going to be, if we're funded and everything that we've heard so far is great, we're getting so close to field station that field season, we're starting to get nervous. But our plan is that we'll be putting machines out in the forest that can record ultrasonic sound, and we'll record whether or not there are bats flying over at nighttime. And there was a study done in partnership with MTRI when we were very first started, I think it was 2005 or 2006, and St. Mary's University did the same kind of thing. So if we can get enough data this year, it's probably going to be mostly zeros, which makes it statistically difficult to compare. But if we can get something, then we could compare it to St. Mary's data from 12 or 13 years ago, and then we'd be able to answer your question, are the populations, what's going on with the population, or if we recorded it for a few years. I can tell you from our hotline that we get hundreds of calls. Most of them are for a single bat, but we're going to be sort of data mining through all the phone calls that we've got over the years and try to see whether there's any chance of any more of these maternity colonies, and where we can try and encourage the stewardship of those locations. Bats are so long lived. They live until they're 30 or 40 years old. They only have one pup a year. Sort of the theory behind it is, any kind of general biology theory, is it will take a very long time for their populations to rebound.
Thank you.
Yep.
Councilor Johnson?
Well, just every time we talk, I get more and more blown away from what not just what you're doing, but you raised a real nice question when you first got into it. How do we break down, get more of that communication out, and the benefit of the partnerships around what's going on at the hub is just absolutely huge. And the work that you're doing, that research is only going to be more and more important as far as I'm concerned, especially with the U.S. saying we're refiring all those coal generators and all that sort of stuff. So just excellent. And I guess my question is, how can we more support what you do, or how can we keep those lines of communications open? Partnerships.
Yeah, we're all
like
so pressed for time. It's hard to,
yeah,
do all the things we want to do. So I really appreciate, I feel that I'm getting to have more, getting to know you as counselors little bit by little bit as we go along, but your council's going to change. So I'm quite open to suggestions. Developing relationships with your staff is helpful because there's that sort of longevity, and they may have more time sometimes than counselors do. I think that's a great question, and perhaps it's something you and I could just have a special meeting to explore, and you could come back to council and see what kind of opportunities there are, because I do regret the sort of distance and the lack of communication, and I feel a little guilty that we've gone ahead and, we are working with the town of Bridgewater, and perhaps I should have reached out to talk to your council about that in the early stages, but, all these things just happen so fast and everybody's so busy that I think we can, hopefully we can still revisit some of those topics and find more ways that we can work together more closely.
The good news is they're happening. They're happening somewhere, so we can all learn from it. So,
mm-hmm.
Thanks, ma'am.
Any other counselors?
Just for word of information.
Deputy Mayor?
Mount Allison University are doing research on Lyme, tick and Lyme disease.
Yeah, that was one of the ones I mentioned.
Yes, yeah.
Mount Allison and Dalhousie.
Councilor Frilly?
Amanda, you mentioned that when you these abandoned places where you found the bats, do you then have the authority to stop the
No,
structure.
We don't have any authority for anything really. So
And
we
do you
work really
work
closely with the Department of Natural Resources, and their wildlife division out of Kentville is great. We have a really great working relationship with them. So when it comes to endangered species, and bats are an endangered species, we always have to just convey information. And that's our role, and that's, I think, part of how we can have a partnership that's so wide across the spectrum is our role, you know, really is about brokering information and trying to be an honest broker and just stick to the facts. This is what's happening. Certainly we're sort of biasing or choosing what topics we work on that'll help bring us closer to our mission, but we don't have any jurisdiction over those things. We certainly can help to with training or facilitating, trying to make things happen, but it's up to the people who own those spaces to manage them.
So is it, so were those houses then destroyed?
Nope.
Okay, so they kept them up, so.
Yeah.
Because just thinking about how we can help, because we have, you know, obviously staff that go out to unsightly premises all the time. So if there were sightings, you know, you would be the first contact, so that could be one way that we help. So
yeah, that's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
Councilor Fancy?
Going back to the Lyme disease issue, of course, I mean, back 10 years ago, you go to the doctor, you had Lyme disease, they didn't even know you had Lyme disease. Cause it, and I think even still now, the testing is very vague to find it if you have.
Yeah, the testing actually is not vague at all. It's
okay.
Very specific.
Okay.
And I just speaking from my own personal experience, I have a friend who lives in New York, and he's contracted Lyme disease now 3 times. But the testing in the USA is I guess the medical community in the USA and in other jurisdictions is much more proactive about Lyme disease than it is here in Canada. And if you go to your veterinarian, you'll find they are also very proactive. So that's what I meant when I said we have to catch up, and from a human health disease, catch up to what's happening even in veterinary offices or the US. So I think that's, you know, quite likely to happen, and the research that's happening at Dalhousie and Mount A, they're trying to understand, it appears that the disease is carried by both species of ticks, but we don't know that much about it. But as with, you know, you might be surprised that I would say this as a scientist, we often have all the information we need, we just need to act on it. And I think that's the case with Lyme's disease, for sure. I'm not speaking because I have any biological information about that, but just more from personal experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to go along with that, do you have any areas where you see, for instance, my son's girlfriend's from Cape Breton. She for ticks, they don't have ticks up there, so she's scared to death coming down here with ticks. So we see that there is different areas for different things, right?
Yeah.
Do you see where Lyme disease is more prevalent here or there, or not here or there, or whatever?
Well, I think from reading the newspapers, I recall that Lunenburg County had some of the hot spots for Lyme disease, but
okay.
I'm just going by memory.
Okay.
The range of the two species of ticks has certainly increased. I grew up in the town of Truro, and the person you're mentioning from Cape Breton would not have seen a tick in my childhood, for sure.
Sure.
But one thing that's sort of promising for our area, and we, from an economic perspective and tourism perspective, we've definitely had the problem of other people in Nova Scotia feel like, you know, Queens County is sort of this epicenter for bugs, whether it's black flies or ticks. But now the whole rest of the province is sharing that, you know, it's actually quite common now to have ticks in Truro. And as I'm sure you all know, many of our towns in mainland Nova Scotia have become great places for white-tailed deer. And where white-tailed deer go, so do the ticks. So,
Councilor Fisk,
still on the subject of Lyme disease, I understand that if you are infected by the Lyme disease, that it's a period of a year to 2 years to clear it out of your system.
I'm not an expert on that, so
I've heard that from people
that
I know that's got Lyme disease. That's what the doctors are saying to them.
Yeah. I can say that we've hosted a number of TikToks, and judging from the interest here at council, it's probably a good time for us to bring in another expert.
Just one more thing on the Lyme disease, deer tick.
Like
so you harvest the deer. What about the meat? Is it safe to eat?
Is deer meat safe to eat?
Well, I mean, here's where I was full of
it. I'll take that on a little bit of a tangent and tell you, we did have, I'm talking about these seminars. So MTRI hosts regular seminars. And I was quite fascinated to have a veterinarian from the Truro area named Helene von Dominic come to MTRI and talk about lead in wildlife. And I actually happened, I was at a conference in New Brunswick just a couple of weeks ago too, and she gave the talk again. And it's quite amazing that we haven't been able to change the culture of hunting so that more copper shot is being used instead of lead. And her x-ray images and personal experience and her review of the literature is quite amazing what a health health impact lead shot can have when you're eating deer meat. So that's not exactly answering your question, but certainly encourage you to come to one of MTRI seminars because you can learn all kinds of things. And if you're a hunter, to consider the extra $6 a year that she calculates it takes to switch to copper ammunition.
Yes, Councillor Kelly?
I would love to come to MTRI. I've known about you for, well, since the beginning, and like to support your, or promote your events that you have out there. But I'd love to come for a tour. If I just call up and make arrangements, I could go out and have a tour.
Well, maybe that could be the thing that Gil and I put on our action list, is that council could maybe have a summer tour to the hub and to MTRI, and just maybe a little more reconnaissance. I don't know if it's something you've already done in the past with the other part of the county.
I'd like to say I'm a proud member of the Butterfly Club, but my milkweed plants died. And maybe I need
we'll
to
guarantee
more.
And replace them.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah,
great. I'll
get you two
more. I'll get new milkweed plants. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, councillors. I think we've probably run through the question period here. Thank you, Amanda, for the very interesting presentation on the work that MTRI does. It's very valuable and very appreciated.
Thank you. So I'll hope to see you again next year, and if we can make a field trip work, that'd be great.
Yes. Thank you.